Good day and welcome to The Medley. I'm your host, Blake Crash Priddle, and this week we have another guest joining us all the way from Possum Lodge. Peter Callahan, better known by some fans as Ranger Gord from The Red Green Show, has an extensive career in acting. Besides The Red Green Show, he also had roles in TV shows like Murdoch Mysteries, 18 to Life, and Ruby Gloom. This week we'll hear some behind-the-scenes stories from his awesome career, and we'll get to learn about some projects that he's working on right now. What journey did you have to take in order to become the successful actor that you are now?
It's a long journey. I've been making a living at it now for probably about 40 years, which is a real treat, and something that I guess I'm very lucky to be able to have done. Went to a lot of theater schools, obviously, at the beginning, and theater school in England and theater schools here. For the most part, I'd have to say that, you know, except for a few lessons here and there about diction and voice quality and breathing and, well, some movement classes, I suppose, though most of it was a waste of time. But at the same time, I came from a family that did not have a lot of experience in anything like the arts, so nobody knew how to guide me. It wasn't like I was Marlon Brando's son, although it'd be a worse situation. Anyway, I had no idea how to be an actor, so, you know, the only advice I got was get all the experience I could possibly get or all the education I could possibly get to be an actor. So I went to theater school in England, and I got a degree in English drama, and et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, at the end of the day, I suppose that experience helped to a certain extent, if only in confidence, and off I went down the road, and I never gave up, you know. I mean, it takes a certain thickness of one's skin in order to be able to go to 4, 5, 6 job interviews a week and be rejected for most, if not all of them, every week after week, and then and keep going, you know.
Did you ever come across anyone in your childhood or perhaps in your adulthood that inspired you to pursue an acting career?
You know, I've been asked this question a few times, but more as inspirations, you know, as inspirations for comedy, and obviously the obvious ones like Monty Python was a huge influence on me, and believe it or not, Bugs Bunny, and specifically Bugs Bunny cartoons directed by a director animator named Chuck Jones, who taught me comic timing, I believe, if you could be taught comic timing. I was taught by that. If you watch something like I think it's called A Night at the Opera, or Bugs at the Opera, or the square dance with Bugs getting cross-dressing as a square dance caller, and, you know, the guy's doing takes the camera. I mean, that's all for me so influential at the beginning in what I did, which was, I suppose, 80-90% comedy at the beginning. And other than that, I had a high school teacher named Harry Wu, who recognized I had some talent as an actor, and very instrumental in influencing me to get on stage, even though I was a desperately shy kid. But I found out pretty early on that I could talk safely with the words of somebody else in my mouth rather than risk the fact that I was being myself and being mocked or ridiculed or any of the other things that shy people are afraid of.
What was your first ever on screen role? Because you have quite the resume, and we're going to talk about Ranger Gord a little bit later, but I'd like to know about the very first time that you appeared on camera. What was that like?
Well, in different permutations, I guess, you know, I started out as an extra in where I grew up in Montreal. So in the 80s, when I was growing up, there was an awful lot of, I guess for a lack of a better word, they were called sort of tax haven productions where, you know, if you were a dentist, you could get tax credits for donating $50,000 to the making of a Canadian movie, as long as it had a Canadian director and a Canadian cinematographer and a Canadian actor. So there was an awful lot of those, but the outcome of that was that there was an awful lot of abuse of the system, so that there was sort of all sorts of nefarious characters getting involved and, you know, soft corn movies being done with tax dollars. So that quickly got shot down. But the good part of it was that on the other side of that, there was quite a few movies made in Montreal, and you could walk around old Montreal and walk from corner to corner and see, Red Square from in Moscow on one corner and a little French town on the next corner. And it was a fantastic time. But, for the most part, bigger roles, and for somebody starting out, there was nothing for you. So I did an awful lot of extra work. So the only sort of decent story I have about that was in a film called, oh gosh, it used to be called Final Assignment. I think it was renamed. It was directed by a guy named Paul Almond, who was a Canadian director, and it was had Burgess Meredith and Michael York and Genevieve Bugeaud. And I played a Russian, I was a Russian soldier extra with an awful lot of ambition. So I quickly figured out, how to be on camera where the camera was pointing. And whenever I went on camera, I happened to just sort of think, I think I'll pause here and do Russian gibberish. So I would pause in front of the camera during various takes, and I would do Russian gibberish. So I'd be on camera and words would be coming out of my mouth. But I would always be told very quickly, no, don't say anything. Just, you can point, but just run off. Just run off quickly. But I didn't. I just kept doing it. I don't know where I got the guts, but I just kept doing it. Eventually, if you find this movie with those three actors in it, you could see me, and they had to dub me into some Russian, had to dub my gibberish Russian into real Russian. And the consequence was, like, I got paid more because I was on camera speaking words, so to speak, my own nonsense words. So anyways, I guess that's the first time I was on camera. And speaking role, I think it was a Jean Coutu commercial in which I said, "Anytime, my friend." It was the very first time I did any kind of on-camera word that I actually legitimately earned and got paid for. So yeah, that would have been, I suppose, yeah, sorry, no, I misspoke about the 80s. It was the 70s when all of those movies came around. So this would have been the late 70s when I did that Final Assignment movie and the Jean Coutu commercial. Because I guess it was 81 where I was already in Toronto.
Well, working with Michael York must have been a cool experience. Michael York, aka Basil Exposition from Austin Powers.
Yeah, very nice man, as I recall. But, it was a terrible cold atmosphere there. There wasn't a lot of money to shoot the movie, and so it was desperately cold in winter, like just physically cold. So I think everybody was really cold, and nobody's mouth was working properly because it was so cold. So it was very difficult to sort of, do any kind of socializing. So we just sort of did our job and went on our way. There I was.
Before doing on-camera work, were you in any school plays or any community theater?
Yes, I wasn't in any of them. I was in all of them. Anything I could possibly get, I got. I did, and so I did. Oh, two or three school plays a year in high school, and then John Abbott College, a professional theater program. I was in a few plays there, and then where did I go after that? I went to Dawson College, and I got an education being in front of a camera instead of on screen. And everybody else in the program at Dawson wanted to be, a director or a producer or a writer, and I was the only one that wanted to be an actor. So I was lucky enough to get all the on camera parts, which was perfect because I, had never had any experience on camera, so I did a lot of that. And then I went to Concordia University, and I did plays there. And then I went to the London Academy in England, and I did plays there. And then I came back, and I did plays at York University. And then I did the Shaw Festival in 1983. And one of the first sort of non-union things I did was a terrible film called Screwballs, 1980, 81, somewhere in there. Unwatchable, so don't even look it up.
But one role that was really good, and that was that of Ranger Gord on the Red Green Show, which is an absolutely iconic Canadian TV show, and it must have been just amazing to play that role.
It was. I mean, Steve Smith and I had history going back before that in a show called The Comedy Mill. And in The Comedy Mill, we did a bunch of different sketches, and I played this very lonely, over-officious Akela, Boy Scout Akela, named Gord. And it turned out really funny. And so the show that he did right after the Comedy Mill was the Red Green Show, where he took a character that he had on this other show called the Comedy Mill, which was kind of a takeoff on the Red Fisher Show, which is probably way before your time, but it was just a guy sitting in a boat talking to friends, fishing, cracking a joke, and then cooking some pickerel and potatoes, and that's the end of the show. So he made a really good run at making it funny, and my gosh, he is genuinely one of the funniest men I have ever worked with. Great story. But the very first time I met him, he gave out audition pieces for everybody to read, which was very smart. You know, he was a producer, he was starting a new show, and he wanted to see if like-minded people had like-minded senses of humor, so we gave everybody the same audition to do. So there I was doing the audition, and it was early in my career, it was early 80s, young, scared, doing the audition. And I could feel the chair that I was sitting on as I was doing the audition sort of creaking and wobbling behind underneath me. Anyway, towards the end of the audition, I leaned back and the whole chair just completely gave out on me. And I literally fell on my ass with my ankles going over my head. And I gathered myself up, and I was incredibly embarrassed. And everybody was sort of saying, "Are you okay?" And then I got up and I said, "Oh, geez, Steve, I'm really sorry. The chair was lousy." And Steve said, "Oh, no. Don't worry about it. You took it a lot better than the last guy." So I thought, yeah, that's pretty funny. I want to work with this guy.
Did you ever talk to any real forest rangers to help you prepare for the role of Ranger Gord?
I can't say I have. I'm sure I have somewhere along the line that there were people that emailed me and that there were actual forest rangers and people that were fans of the show that sort of anteed in every once in a while. And nothing really comes to mind. I know that there were certain people that wanted to become forest rangers and asking me for advice. Not much I can tell you there, my friend. So yeah, I'd have to say, not that comes to mind. And I forgive, I apologize to anybody I may have omitted.
Yeah, my mom used to be in a junior rangers program back in the day, and she said that it was a very challenging job. And I know that Ranger Gord, he liked what he did, but he was also very lonely. So I always tried to find some ways to stay occupied up in the tower, even if that meant doing something like playing the guitar to 8-track.
Yeah, and not knowing how to play the guitar either. So yeah.
I think one of my favorite Ranger Gord moments was when Ranger Gord and Red, they were playing a game called Grab-A-Tat. That was where you would reach into a box and then you would pull out some kind of a plant and you had to name what plant it was. And Red Green pulled out a leaf that he thought was mint, and Ranger Gord says, "Nope, try again. No, it's got to be mint." And he says, "Nope, it's poison ivy." Remember that?
Yeah, I remember that. Very funny. Gosh, he was funny. And the cartoons we did were a great time too. And it was a guy that was straight out of animation school, Sheridan College. Sheridan College? I think it was Sheridan. Anyway, Steve enlisted him to make these very, you know, cheap, fast cartoons, which I guess is very sort of early CGI, computer-generated stuff. And so these things would pop up, and they would obviously be very funny because it would be written by Steve or Rick or whatever, Rick Green. And I would sit there in the studio, and I would just record them all in a day, you know, 8-10 cartoons, and do all the voices at the same time. And I'd start with Ranger Gord, and then I'd go on to Red, and then I'd go on to Harold or whoever else I was doing, and do all their lines at the same time. So it wouldn't be confusing, but it was so much fun to do those. And they turned out really well. I know younger kids are enamored of those things. They're actually talking about making an animated Red Green now. I don't think I'm being too, I don't think I'm letting the cat out of the bag and saying I'm not supposed to say it, but I think they are making an animated Red Green show.
Do you have any other fond memories of working with Steve Smith or Rick Green that you'd like to share with us? I mean, I know that there's definitely lots of them, you know, doing things like playing the word game or other crazy things that you did.
Well, you know, the show, the Red Green show, started off very, very, very low key, and there was very little money at the beginning. And I do distinctly remember the production manager who also made lunch, whose mother also made lunch, and who also drove the car, and who also made the props, and me and Steve, and excuse me, one camera guy who also did the sound would find, or the production manager found a kid's treehouse somewhere in Hamilton. And it was built between two or three pretty rickety looking trees, and it wasn't that new. And we'd get up there, the three guys, the weight of us, and on a windy day, the thing used to sway like crazy. And we thought, okay, we're either going to do this and it'll be funny, or we're going to do this and we'll die. So it'll be in memorandum of memoriam of all of us dying in this treehouse. And it eventually graduated to us being in this very opulent set on the CBC with a CGI background of forest and a beautifully made treehouse, and in between Port Carling on a real treehouse and a real sort of 80, 100-foot treehouse. I mean, lots of great memories. I mean, Steve had a cottage for years on Moon River in the Muskokas, and whenever we had some time off, he would invite whoever the people were that were, you know, up the next week to go and spend a night or two, and we'd go up and we'd learn lines and we'd make up new stuff. And as jobs go, it was one of the most satisfying jobs I've ever had. Harold, that character, the character of Harold, started on the Second City stage, and I did the touring company with Pat McKenna. I've known Pat, I want to say, since the mid 80s. When his baby was born, I remember, and we would do a sketch, and I don't remember exactly what the sketch was, but the point was I was supposed to be a very sort of stoic, conservative father with a tie and a pipe and a cardigan and reading my newspaper, and McKenna used to show up as this Harold character, but with 10 times more energy, and he'd stand a foot and a half away from my head and undulate, and I just, for the life of me, and the audience, you know, people that came and saw the show more than once would say they came back just to see if I could hold it together for McKenna doing that character in front of me. And he knew what he was doing. Because he not only he did that character, but he wore a swimming cap at the same time. And if you can imagine Harold with a swimming cap on and glasses doing that, it was virtually impossible. I defy anybody to try to keep it together when he did that a foot and a half away from you. But we you know, he again, one of the funniest guys I know, and we've remained friends for forever. But I guess I, you know, if you know, Pat was is one of those guys that is good for the funny, and I'm sort of, you know, we're great. We always thought we'd do a great sort of Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis duo, because I'd be the straight guy and he'd be the Jerry Lewis type, or, you know, and every once in a while we'd do a fundraiser and we'd do something where I'd sing a Dean Martin song and he'd, you know, do a Jerry Lewis type thing around me. But yeah, we've been friends ever since.
I can imagine that at times it was probably hard to keep a straight face on the set of the Red Green Show or the other comedy roles that you were a part of, because I know lots of people, myself included, that can barely keep a straight face watching the show in the living room, let alone on the set.
Yeah, very much. And it made even more difficult when the show, I think for the first, how many years it was on? It's got to have been on 15, 17 years or something. But for the last, I want to say maybe 7 years, it was in front of a live audience. And, you know, we had hardly had time. Like, we'd show up on at the CBC at around 2 o'clock and we'd do a run through of the sketches. So you had to know your lines, you had to know what you were doing, you had to know your character. You do that, the camera would also be a camera rehearsal for the studio, and then I think at around 6 or 7 o'clock
they let the audience in, and we do two shows. We do one at 7 and one at 8, or something like that. But that was difficult. Like, you know, when you weren't too used to what McKenna or Steve would be doing, you know, there'd be times when you would just laugh. But, you know, the audience enjoyed it, but it's the kind of thing where you had to sort of back up and do it all again, and you couldn't do it the same way because it was in front of an audience, and, you know, you'd have to sort of switch it up a little bit so they would laugh a little differently or a little bit more than, you know, the first time.
Speaking of the CBC, you had a reoccurring role on Murdoch Mysteries as Terrence Myers. What did you have to do to prepare for that role, which is more dramatic than the role of Ranger Gord?
Just be a little bit more condensed, to be a little bit more serious, just tone it down. I think I've always, I mean, I, in the recent years, I may be doing 50-50 comedy drama, but in the past, it was always more comedy. So, you know, that was a bit of a gift to me. That, I guess, is 17 years too, but 17 years ago, I did the first Murdoch Mysteries. And, it was offered to me as a role that I, you know, didn't have to audition for, and I thought, okay, I'm gonna have fun with this one, and I guess I just channeled my best James Bond or something, because the guy was Canada's first spy, and or allegedly Canada's first spy. And it wasn't very clear if he was a good guy or a bad guy. It was very ambiguous. So, I just had fun, and he'd come out of the shadows, and he'd have all of these sort of grandiose international schemes afoot. When Yannick Bisson's character was more provincially Toronto and small town, and it provided that level of grandiosity to the show that I think they really were looking for. And I guess that to a certain extent, the more pomposity or self-importance I could put into the character, the more it would sort of reflect on the international intrigue that was afoot in my world. And so I guess that's in a nutshell what I did.
Another series that you were on was called 18 to Life. That was a short-lived sitcom. I have to admit, I never watched that show. What's it about?
Oh, it's 18 to Life was, it was two families living side by side in a suburban neighborhood. Myself and Ellen David played a very sort of uptight conservative family, the cardigan wearing, proper private schools, et cetera, et cetera. I was a judge. She was, stay-at-home mom, but very, regimented. And next door was another couple who were hippies, for lack of a better word. They were free-spirited, very left-leaning, liberal, easy-go-lucky, don't-have-to-cut-the-lawn type of family. They had two kids. We had two kids. Our son falls in love with their daughter. They're both 18 years old, and they decide to get married, which sends our families into spasms of confusion, and then ultimately has to bring the families together, the conservatives and the libs next door, liberals next door. So that's sort of the story in a nutshell.
So you played a character that was the exact opposite of you in a lot of ways.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Which I enjoy doing. I mean, I've always enjoyed playing stupidity very confidently. And I sort of regard very right-leaning people kind of dim-witted. So I love playing them with a great deal of confidence and authority. I get a laugh out of that, but it's the antithesis of who I am, which is somewhere between NDP and Liberal. And so I've always had fun doing that.
It's pretty much where you and I stand as well. And it's a lot like the guy that played Archie Bunker, Carol O'Connor, was the exact opposite of his character in real life. So that's something that the two of you have in common.
Is that right? Yeah. Well, it's always easier to make fun of them that way, because you can
you can put an extra level of self-importance on them, which makes people roll their eyes.
Now, besides the cartoons on the Red Green Show, you did a few other voiceovers for cartoons, including the role of Scaredy Bat in the animated series Ruby Gloom, which used to be on YTV back when I was a kid.
Well, Scaredy Bat was always South Asian, and, you know, obviously it would be cultural appropriation today, but, you know, and it just wouldn't be done. We would have to get a South Asian actor to do it. But, you know, at the time, in the 70s, 80s, when I was starting out, it was you know, very much an asset to be able to do accents. You know, it would be a huge asset for voiceovers, for characters, for anything. But now it's the opposite. It's frowned upon. So Scaredy Bat was just this South Asian kind of very, very sort of sing-songy kind of guy, you know. And I had a teacher in college who taught, what did he teach? Sort of a psychology course or anyways, he was very South Asian. He sounded like Deepak Chopra, a great, great, great man, very smart. But I learned an accent for him. And then they would electronically pitch it up so he would be, you know, two octaves higher than my voice was.
Do you find it easier to do voice acting over live action acting, or vice versa?
Oh, it's infinitely easier to do voice acting, yeah. Because really it's just, you know, you and a microphone. 9 times out of 10, you're not acting with other characters, so you're not really having to, there's very little prep work for any kind of back and forth or rehearsal of any kind. You generally just go in with a script, and you'd have all of your lines that you do individually, and the director would have to sit there and say, "Oh no, you're, you know, all this screaming here is because you're falling headways down the stairs, and all the yelling here is because your mother just threw you in the water," or whatever it is that, you know, they would have to describe what the action was, because you wouldn't generally know too much about what the story is. I mean, you get the script and you sort of have a good idea where what's coming up. So yeah, it's much easier, and you can, you know, stand there in your jeans and t-shirt and just have fun for a couple hours. And it was a great deal of fun.
Because I like working in radio too, because then you don't have to worry about putting makeup or combing your hair or anything like that too, since you're just in front of the microphone.
Well, exactly right. I mean, right as we speak, I'm having a bath. Not really, no.
Yeah, I kind of knew you weren't, but you've done all kinds of roles over the years, both dramatic and comedic. Would you prefer to do dramatic or comedic roles?
You know, I'm gonna have to defer to the comedic roles. I think it's always been a lot more fun to do comedic roles, but at the same time, I think that if I have a strength in comedy, it's playing comedy straight. In other words, it's playing comedy with a great, you know, great deal of confidence. And in other words, I'm not trying to, you know, with a few exceptions here and there, obviously, but I'm not trying to be cartoony or goofy or, you know, set up a punchline. It's me trying to infiltrate a character. It's like The Newsroom, where I did play this character that was a profoundly stupid but yet extremely confident, and got away with being an anchor man for decades, and playing it straight. And the more I played it straight, I do find the funnier it gets. So that's what I really like doing. So if I transpose that from doing comedy into doing drama, it's not a huge leap from playing comedy straight to just being straighter. I'm just not delivering any kind of humor or ridiculous situation. But if I can, in comedy, I think it's much more difficult to, in playing comedy straight, it's much more difficult to be able to convince somebody that you're as dumb as, you know, like in The Newsroom. Oh, it's an example. I thought a woman said to me that
the choice for abortion should be between the woman, her doctor, and her dog. And I get reproached for that because I thought it was dog. And he said, I just misheard. I thought she said dog. I didn't think she said God. Of course it's God. A woman, a doctor, and her God, not her dog. But, you know, you carry that on and you sort of, if you can make the audience believe that you really believe that for a few minutes, you've done your job, and I find that pretty satisfying.
That's actually a very good tip for potential comedians out there that may be struggling to figure out ways to tell good jokes. I think that's...
Well, you know, it depends on the style. It, you know, I mean, there's something to be said about all kinds. You know, I mean, Ron James has a very different delivery. Pat McKenna has very different delivery than I do. But, you know, I just... This is my... I don't know, line. This is my trail of entertainment, and everybody can pick out a niche. If it works for you, great. If it doesn't work for you, try something else.
Now, the industry has been struggling the past couple of months with strikes and with filming delays and people struggling to get work. Is there anything that you'd like to tell actors out there that may be having a hard time landing jobs or maybe struggling in the industry?
You know, it's a very difficult time right now. I think that, especially as a Canadian actor, you really have to sort of be a Canadian activist as well. So I think an awful lot of union work feeds directly into that sort of line of thinking. And by that, I mean that, you know, I mean, my father-in-law who passed away last year, he was advocating for Canadian arts and culture and the 50s and the 60s and somebody before him, and then there'd be somebody after me. But I think it's an ongoing fight that we have to be very vigilant that we don't disappear in the ethers among a monolithic culture like the Americas or even Britain. I think we always compared ourselves as colonists to the British in the 40s and 50s. My late mother-in-law used to do theater and 40s, 50s, and 60s in Toronto, and if it wasn't a British show, if it was a Canadian show, it was sort of frowned upon. It couldn't possibly be as good as a British show. And similarly on our you know, standard broadcast styles in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and now that it has come into, you know, streaming and various platforms for entertainment delivery, it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we maintain our standards of culture, and we do have standards of culture that's heads and shoulders above many others, especially what's happening in America right now. It's a very important matter. I think we need to tell Canadian stories by and for Canadians, and if we lose that voice, I think we'll just be this nebulous ooze of culture without any kind of identity, which ultimately gives us all pride and meaning for who and what we are and where we came from and where we're going. The mythology of, you know, anything from John Wayne and the Wild West of the United States to the astronaut program to anything else that goes on, it's very strengthening for our culture, and we have to make sure that we tell stories like that of and by us. Having said that, it's very difficult because the money generally flows to celebrities, and we also need to make sure that we celebrate success more than we have in this country. I think it's always been very difficult for any kind of, lack of a better word, star system in this country, because we generally don't like to celebrate success. I think if you take an example of, Mike Myers or Ryan Gosling or Ryan Reynolds coming back to Canada to work, you would automatically think, oh, I guess they're not doing so well there because they want to work in this country. And I think it should be the other way around. I think if they're coming back here, it's because it's important for them to revel in their own culture. But, you know, that's the way it's been set up for decades, and it's going to be continuing that way for a long time. It's the Olympics down in Hollywood, and it's a bit of a sideshow here, but we do have to make sure that we carve out a piece of our own pie, or
make sure that our side of the foundation is strong.
A lot of times actors are on gag orders and they can't really talk about upcoming projects, but are there any upcoming projects that you're working on now that you are allowed to tell us?
Well, I'm working on a film that is about, it's kind of a, it's kind of a funny traditional Christmas movie, a very, albeit a very smart, very sort of a Ted Lasso type movie, Christmas movie about 60 something people falling in love instead of 20 or 30 something people falling in love at Christmas. So that's coming down the way. Hopefully we'll get that started this summer. I just started a recurring part or a possible recurring part on a show called, Sullivan's Crossing. Murdoch will be coming back. I think Red Green is doing a cartoon. Pretty happy with a show I did for, it's called Family Law, and it aired down in the States on Acorn a couple of weeks ago, and for an odd twist, it doesn't air in Canada for another few months.
Well, I look forward to seeing those projects, and Peter, it was great to have you on the Medley this week, and I wish you the best of luck with your future endeavors.
Thanks, Blake. Thanks for having me.
And that was Canadian actor Peter Callahan, better known as Ranger Gord. I'm Blake Crash Priddle, and I hope that you enjoyed this week's edition of The Medley. And don't forget, we're all kinds of different. Keep your stick on the ice.